Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, just out on the WGN Storm Center patio where the weather is starting to warm up a little bit. I'm supposed to get up into the 40s today, which I can't complain about that on this February 7th. Joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is my friend Michael Golden. Michael is the author of Unlock Congress. He also teaches at Benedictine University, and you just got a new position too at Arizona State.
Arizona State in the spring and then back in the summer at Benedictine with Phil Hardy and Tammy Sarver. Great people, a great department, and I've spoken at the Civic Leadership Center out there. Just a wonderful program at Benedictine, so I'm really excited about it. And thanks for having me today, Rick.
Well,
I love coming in here.
And we've talked about the book before, and we haven't been on before, and now it's being used as curricula at Ohio State, ASU, Arizona State, UIC, Elmhurst College, Benedictine. That's fantastic.
You know Dick Simpson for a long
right.
time, and he's using it in an American government class, and then I'm coming in early April to talk to a class of 160 students. So that's really exciting. You know, he's one of our political deans in terms of academia in Chicago. So I'm really grateful to Dick. So many people, especially in the Chicago community where we're from, have been really great.
Well, and, you know, as you note, the book is Unlock Congress. But still, there are issues in Congress that actually you see it surface in the presidential campaigns. And I know, number one, the whole issue of money. I mean, is unbelievable. And when you look at the money that is being poured in by particularly the candidate super PACs, I mean, it's just unbelievable. And we'll have David Yepsen on later, but, you know, he's just back from Iowa, but just the nonstop, incessant advertising that's all part of the modern-day presidential campaigns.
Yeah, you know, and David knows this all too well, and so do you. We watched it for years, and I write about it a lot in the book on the congressional level, but in the presidential race, at least a couple months ago, the figures were that super PAC money coming in, half of the money that was going into the presidential race was from less than 150 families in the United States of America, which is it's almost the definition of oligarchy.
The New York Times, I think, was doing a series on these political families.
I'll tell you, but the good thing is, and I think it's different in congressional races because so many candidates have no name ID and they don't get national, obviously, as much airtime as these presidential candidates are. But I would say there's one good thing this election cycle when it comes to the money in the presidential race, and that is that a couple of these candidates have really maneuvered their way to the top of the polls without spending a fortune. And the most stark example of the reverse of that is obviously Jeb Bush, who's spent the most and, to many people, shockingly, has done so poorly. And I wrote an article in a column in Roll Call a couple of weeks ago about, and you know this better than anybody, the value of being good on television, not just the ads, but in the presidential race. You better seem confident and think on your feet. And we had an example of that hurting Marco Rubio last night. He fell into a trap that was set for him, and then he fell further into it. Television's so powerful.
Well, the whole issue with Rubio, where Chris Christie had said he was going to come at him at some point,
right,
and basically just blasted him on lack of experience, that kind of thing, and then to see Rubio come back with just kind of his rote answers, repeatedly
three times,
and I did like Chris Christie's crack about kind of the drive-by Washington,
right,
25-second soundbite answer. And Rubio looked like a deer in the headlights.
I was actually shocked because not at the criticism, but Rubio did this twice. In fact, the third time, Christie cut him off and said, "There you go, folks. There's his stock line." I'm paraphrasing.
Right.
I mean, he just it was a little bit embarrassing. That's one of those things where presidential primaries, they, you know, we say it's this grueling job interview, and it really is, because eventually you get down to the core of who these guys are. That was Marco Rubio's chance to think on his feet and push right back, and he fell right into that trap. I actually think his nerves got the better of him.
Well, and he did look visibly
shaken.
Yes. And you know, what's surprising to me is, obviously, one, the lack of prep, knowing that something like this was going to be coming, particularly after his finish in Iowa, where, you know, Iowa, he's the rising star, and basically tries to paint third place as a victory and taking a victory lap. And I think he was too busy still trying to take this victory lap without focusing on what's ahead. And I have to wonder how much at this stage of the game, and, you know, New Hampshire voters are traditionally
late breakers,
and whether this so close to Tuesday's primary, what effect that may have on a guy, as I said, who was kind of viewed as somebody who was rising.
It's a fascinating dynamic. Setting aside even Trump for a moment, these governors got to be just pulling their hair out, because they do take chief executive service seriously, and it is a different experience. The problem is that there were four or five of them in the beginning, and one hasn't been able to break through. That's the irony, is that you've got this big mouth, Trump, and then you've got two senators in second and third, and traditionally we elect governors in this country, and you have a few of them, whether you are right, left, or center. You can't argue that Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, and John Kasich aren't very experienced governors, both reelected in their states. You know, they have varying records and so forth, but they're fighting with each other for that lane, and I'm sure in private it's driving them nuts.
Oh, yeah, but although I am curious, and there, in the polling that we've seen in New Hampshire, there seems to be some movement for John Kasich.
Absolutely.
And I'm not sure what that reflects. If that's people looking for that establishment experience lane, I guess.
You know, I think that there's a couple things about John Kasich. I have to say, and I could end up obviously being wrong. I have been about Trump. But 6 months ago,
Everybody's been wrong about
Trump.
That's true.
That's true. 8 months ago, right, even before Kasich announced, but you knew he was going to, I really thought that he had a good shot of being the dark horse in this race and surprising people, because, on paper, he beats them all. He was chair of the finance committee in Congress, so he has that talking point, and that's his record.
Right.
He was the quote architect of those balanced budgets with Bill Clinton and divided government back then. I think he was on the Armed Services Committee, but he also. Then he was a congressman, and then elected twice in the biggest state there is for the Republicans in a presidential race, reelected by overwhelming numbers, and on paper there he turned that budget around. Now, Ohio had a couple good things happen to their economy, and he's taking credit for that, but still on paper, and he's a governor in a swing state, he's a reasonable, rational guy most of the time, and he had his own television show on Fox, so it's not like he's a stranger to the art of being on television. And he's really, like Christie, staked everything on New Hampshire. And also, I think the difference is he's been really disciplined the last couple of months about being the positive guy. And you saw it last night, where he was annoyed a couple of months ago in those debates, and you could tell, he got a little irritated. He would not take the bait, and he doesn't with reporters either, in hammering the other candidates. And if you're able to do that enough where you're that guy out of a field of whatever, seven or eight or nine remaining, that appeals to especially a lot of the independents in New Hampshire, where you can register and vote in either primary. So his numbers look good, but again, he's got the problem against going two other reasonable governors who have a good record. Those three guys are tearing it up. But I think that Rubio may have lost some support last night.
But it also seems to me too, with Kasich, for example, is he's not been given the time that other candidates have. And I think in some of those earlier debates, part of that anger was having to try to force him trying to force himself into the conversation.
He complained about it too. Right. I mean, a few of them have done that in debates. I frankly don't blame him. When I see those candidates up there and one of them isn't get asked a question for 25 minutes of the debate, I feel like they're going to explode. But that's the problem with such a crowded field. That Democratic debate this past week was one of the best debates I've ever seen on the presidential level in terms of substance, fair moderation, by the hosts. And an exchange of ideas, staking out their positions and then defending. And then they even had a spontaneous handshake before it was even over. I mean, it's getting a little testier now, but people got to learn a lot about both of them. But as you say, part of that dynamic is there's only two candidates.
Right.
There's more time.
We're speaking with Michael Golden, the author of Unlock Congress, and we're talking about the presidential race. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio. And joining me here in studio is Michael Golden, the author of Unlock Congress. And we're talking about the presidential race. And, Michael, you mentioned the story you wrote about in Roll Call about how important television is. And you having been a former television news reporter, Trump, without TV, there is no Donald Trump.
Nope.
I mean, he is the master manipulator.
Yep.
But, when you watch some of these debates, too, and in some of these forums, the moderators are obviously playing to have Trump talk.
They are. They are. I wrote a different column about that. The media's catch-22. It's a dance. And I used to be, as you know, out in California, I used to cover politics for an NBC affiliate back in the 90s and in the Central Valley, which was the swing vote capital of California. So even back then when it was Dole versus Clinton, and Kemp, and these guys would come through. But now with all the digital channels and the, minute-to-minute video that's uploaded to the web, it's not even television, it's video, right? It's being on camera. It's more important than ever. And the networks, I got pretty highfalutin in that column a couple weeks ago about the media's catch-22 with Trump. They all cover him live in these events for half an hour at a time. They don't cover Sanders half an hour at a time. Matt Bai said on Meet the Press about a month ago in front of his journalism brethren and the nation at 9 a.m. on a, Sunday morning, he said, I think we've done a huge disservice to the American public by pumping up Donald Trump for months. We've been complicit in where he is. And he wasn't saying it against Trump per se. He's just saying, if we give any candidate that's this entertaining this much airtime and not the other candidates, that's not what journalism is about. That's what if you were programming primetime entertainment, The Apprentice or The Celebrity, that's what that's about. But the problem is these are all companies. These are not nonprofit entities. They have to get eyeballs to drive ratings. It's not that complicated. And I fought against that even when I was a local news reporter. It bothered me then. It's one of the reasons I left. And it's a tough one, right? Because if they don't take Trump live, everybody who wants to see the goofy show clicks over to the other national cable network that's carrying him. It's a really dicey thing, and I think a lot of those broadcasters and journalists know it, but they don't want to become irrelevant. It's a catch-22. And my point is that let's just do better. In fact, I urged when he skipped that debate and did his veterans stunt. I mean, he could write a check for $6 million. He doesn't need to do this manipulative stunt when he's too scared to come to a debate. I thought all the networks should agree to not cover him. Cover the debate, cover other things, make a stand that we're not going to get sucked into this because it's not news. What it is someone using us to sensationalize something for their political
benefit. It becomes the media's enablers.
Absolutely. Now, there's a lot of people who disagree and say, well, it is news. Just by virtue of he may be, a coward for not going to the debate, but that's news. Okay, fine. But what you're doing is you're playing right into his hand.
Well, as someone who was supposed to appear on a national cable news show and was basically preempted because they were taking Donald Trump live. I know exactly what you're talking about. And yeah, I mean, it is a catch-22, but at the same time, you kind of, as you say, there should be doing better. Then you should be taking a half hour of each one of these candidates then, or 10 minutes or something to try to, you know, play fair.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if you saw this, but I think a week or two ago there was an article in Politico about how Donald Trump, that this was not some rash decision to run for president, that he had been planning this for 3 or 4 years, and that he was very studied about the media. I think that Morton Downey Jr. actually rented from him many years ago. Remember when he was all the rage for less than 2 years on television, and he started all this huge arguing live and making it, you know, this sort of circus in live television. And Donald Trump knew what he was doing. A lot of the things he says, I think, are off the cuff, and he goes by instinct, but he knew darn well that once he started and got them hooked on a completely different campaign where he was saying what he thought and just didn't care because he doesn't have to raise money, that they would follow him. I don't think he had any idea that it would be this, he'd get this kind of coverage. But this was strategically decided by him a while ago. In fact, I think that's why that whole birther thing with Obama started a few years ago. He was testing the waters to see just how much attention can I get playing on people's either anger, fears, or dislike of the president, and doing it in a way that's much louder, you know, having investigators go to Hawaii and whatever he did.
Well, and of course, when we look at the polls in New Hampshire, and he's the front runner there. And it is a primary versus a caucus in Iowa, which is a whole different kind of organizational effort for the presidency versus, you know, a primary. But I still have to wonder, as strategic as Donald Trump is, about in the end, it's all about brand. And, you know, winning and losing the brand. And I mean, as a businessman, it would seem like the downside is much greater than the upside.
For him as a businessman?
Yes.
Depending on what happens with the campaign. You know, what he does, he doesn't, you know, he talks about building all the time, but it's a fact that he does a ton of licensing of his name, you know.
Sure.
So I don't know how much this would hurt him. You know, it's that old expression, any ink is good ink, or any, you know, any attention you get in PR is good attention. You know, he's an incredibly polarizing figure. Just the people in the electorate who love him, most of them keep on loving him. And he has the highest unfavorables too, right?
Right.
There's 35% to 40% in New Hampshire who said, I won't vote for Trump under any circumstances. There are some people who still don't think he's serious, that he just keeps saying crazy things because he's looking for a way out. I don't agree with that. I think he wants to be president.
Michael, very quickly, on the Democratic side,
yeah,
you look at that close race in Iowa. Yes, the debates are very informative, but you've got Bernie Sanders with a big lead in New Hampshire. And I would argue that, and we'll go into this later too, but I would argue that I don't think Hillary Clinton actually won Iowa. And I don't mean, yes, she did, but I don't view that as a victory.
No, right. And actually, so I'm so glad that it's probably our final minutes. I'm glad that you brought that up, because it ties right into the television conversation. Bernie Sanders, he may be old and hunched, older and hunched, and seem like this sort of irritated,
angry,
avuncular figure. Yeah, but he is as authentic as a guy can be who's been in politics for 30 years. And that's what all these young people like when he's on television. They like his message too, I think, a great deal, because they're worried about their future. And he is far more progressive on some of these positions than Hillary Clinton is. But she has been on television for more than 20 years, and she's just not good at it. This is an aptitude television. Some people will never get much better. You watch Bill Clinton at some of these rallies next to her, it just looks painful, because he's a natural. Barack Obama's a natural. Ronald Reagan was a natural. Even George W. Bush, who didn't come off as the most erudite political candidate, he was likable. There was something folksy and confident about him. Hillary Clinton seems scripted and calculated. She's a very smart and capable person, no matter what your politics are. But when that red light goes on, there's not a lot of warmth or authenticity there. And the irony is that, like Mitt Romney, like Al Gore, like a lot of candidates, the people that know them say that in person, and I've experienced this. I wrote a speech once for Al Gore in Missouri. And we went over it for 20 minutes before he went up on stage. He was warm, smart, engaging, curious, asked questions about all these different local facts. Then he went up on stage in front of 300 Democrats, no cameras. It was a rally just to get the troops fired up. And he didn't read a word of my speech, and he was fantastic. He was at ease. So if you see him on Letterman, whatever the talk show is now, he's great in that setting. But if he's answering political questions, just like Hillary Clinton, just like Mitt Romney, they freeze up.
And it's the authenticity factor.
It kills them.
That's Michael Golden, author of Unlock Congress. And Michael, thank you so much for joining me this morning. I appreciate you getting up.
It's always great to be here. Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back with more right after this.